Introduction to Daniel, Part 2. The second talk in a series on Daniel was presented by David Crabtree on April 26, 2020, at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by David Crabtree and is being made available to you by Gutenberg College. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. Contributions to David Crabtree may be made at www.soundinterp.wordpress.com. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
Welcome to Virtual Reformation Fellowship. This week we're going to be looking at the story of the Tower of Babel, and I'll explain why briefly. But there was a question from last week. Jan sent me a question. I'll read you the question and then I want to respond to it. She said, could you describe in more detail the events in Judah in 605 BC? You mentioned Babylonians coming to Jerusalem and collecting tribute, some temple vessels and maybe 1,000 young men. Later you mentioned the destruction of the temple. When we hear of the Babylonian captivity, it was surely more than these young men. Was the temple destroyed as a part of the collecting tribute, or did the Babylonians return later for more destruction and take more people? This is a difficult question to answer because the information is sparse and conflicting. But let me give you the best guess as to how to reconstruct the events that took place. In 605 BC, there was the Battle of Carchemish, which Nebuchadnezzar, who was not the king at the time, he was the son of the king, but he was the general, the main general for the Babylonian army. He defeated the Assyrian army, what remained of the Assyrian army. The Babylonians had been fighting against the Assyrians, trying to overthrow Assyrian control for about 22 years. All of that was started by Nebuchadnezzar's father, Nabopolassar. And Nabopolassar formed an alliance with the Medes and the Scythians. And together, they fought against the Assyrians, drove them out of their capital city of Nineveh. But the Assyrian army retreated into Syria, into what is modern-day Syria. And it's there that Nebuchadnezzar attacked him at Carchemish. And he completely destroyed the Assyrian army at that point and defeated the Egyptians who had come to help the Assyrian army. The Egyptians didn't generally help the Assyrians, but in this situation, they were so afraid of the Babylonians that they came to help the Assyrians. But Nebuchadnezzar defeated both of them. And after he defeated them, the Egyptians, they fled back to Egypt. So Nebuchadnezzar had free run in Palestine and Phoenicia, and he took advantage of that. Now, the timing is a little bit difficult. We know that Nebuchadnezzar went back to Babylon in the summer of 605 because his father died and he was crowned king. It was either before he went back to Babylon after the Battle of Carchemish, or he went back to Babylon and then came back to Palestine and Phoenicia after he was crowned king. We don't know which it is, but we know that he was in Palestine in particular. He's also in Phoenicia, and he collected tribute from a number of the kingdoms in the area. Ashkelon, a Philistine city-state, resisted Nebuchadnezzar. He besieged it, and then once he was able to defeat them, he completely destroyed Ashkelon. So we know that that was happening in 605. And we know that he was going around collecting tribute. We also know from Daniel that Daniel was taken into exile in 605. So it seems highly likely that either before he was crowned king or after he was crowned king in 605, he took some people from Judah to Babylon, back to Babylon with him, as well as the vessels from the temple. But We don't know how many people were taken at that time. Some people guess it was 1,000 or 2,000, but we don't really know. That's just a guess. There were other deportations. The Babylonians came in 597, I think it is, because Jehoiakim had rebelled against Babylonian control and stopped paying tribute. The Babylonians didn't like that. So they came and they were able to bring Judah to their knees. And he took a large number of people into exile at that time. Then in 587, I think it is, that's when they came again. And this time Nebuchadnezzar was mad and he besieged Jerusalem, destroyed it, and destroyed the temple, and took more tribute and took more people into exile. It is highly likely that there was another time that they came and took exiles. I have this in an appendix to the notes if you want to look at it. And that was in 582. We know that he also took some captives back to Babylon. It is highly likely that there were three or four other times when he took captives. I don't know exactly what the dates are on that, but there were likely seven different deportations. But there are three main ones, and that's what Jeremiah talks about. There were three main ones. And those were 97. I'll read these so I get them right. 597, 586, and 582. Now, why Jeremiah doesn't count the time when Daniel was taken into Babylon, I'm not sure. It may be that there were just too few for that to count for him. And it's possible that some of those later deportations were small in number as well. When people guess at the number of people that were taken, when scholars guess of the total number of people taken into exile, the guesses are usually between 20,000 and 50,000 people total. We know that when the first wave of people came back from Babylon to Judah, there were 50,000 people in that wave, and then there were other waves. So there were quite a few people that were taken into exile into Babylon. All right. I hope that answers Jan's question. Okay. I want to look at the story of Babel today. And the reason I want to look at the story of the Tower of Babel is because of the first two verses in chapter 1 of Daniel. And I'll read those. It says, in the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it. So that's 605. And the Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand, along with some of the vessels of the house of God. And he brought them to the land of Shinar, to the house of his God. And he brought the vessels into the treasury of his God. So this tells us that in 605, that he brought vessels from the temple and he brought them to Shinar. It doesn't say it specifically, but he also brought some people, including Daniel. It's interesting that it says he brought them to the land of Shinar. Shinar is a rare term. It only occurs 8 times in the Old Testament. It was never used by the Babylonians to refer to the land in which they lived. It was a term that was only used by foreigners with respect to, in reference to, the land of Babylon. Why would Daniel use this word where Babylon is the clear referent? I think it's because, and why didn't he use the word Babylon? I think it's because he wants to, their associations with the term Shinar that he wants to tap into. And I think that Daniel wants to encourage the reader to reflect upon the story of the Tower of Babel. Let's look at the different times. I just want to refer to the different times that it's used in the Old Testament. There are only 8 times. One of them is in Genesis 10:10, when it's talking about the beginning of Nimrod's kingdom. Nimrod is a conqueror, descended from Ham, and it refers to his kingdom as including Shinar. The second time and the third time that it's used is with reference to the four kings who raided Palestine when Abraham was there. If you recall, it was the time that they raided Sodom and Gomorrah. Abraham chased them out and returned the plunder that they had stolen. One of those kings was from Shinar. The fourth time is in reference to the sin of Achan. If you'll recall, in Joshua, they had taken Jericho, but God had given them strict instructions not to take anything, not to take any plunder. Well, Achan did. He took a few things. One thing that's mentioned specifically is a mantle from Shinar. So that was too seductive for him to refuse. He had to have it. He grabbed it and he snuck off with it, thinking that no one would care. But they were defeated in the next battle, and Joshua asked God what had happened, and God said somebody stole something that they shouldn't have taken. The next time that it's used is in Isaiah 11:11. God talks about the places from which he will gather his people. And one of the places from which he will gather his people is listed as Shinar. Then the last place where it's used in the Old Testament is in Zechariah, where it says that a temple will be built for wickedness. Wickedness is personified as a woman who is carried to the land of Shinar. And there in Shinar, a temple will be built for this woman, wickedness. So the only other place where where Shinar is used is in the story of the Tower of Babel in Genesis 11 that we'll look at in just a moment. But the term Shinar seems to connote oppressive power and seductive attraction. And that is a term that I think is very intentionally used. I mean, it'd be kind of like referring to Las Vegas as Sin City or something like that, or Washington, D.C. as the swamp. It's not just a geographical location that's being referred to. There are connotations that come with it. And Shinar is used here not just to identify geographically where this is taking place, but rather the connotations that come with it are important. And a significant connotation coming with that, I think, is attached to the story of the Tower of Babel. I'll point out that the term Babel that we find in our English translations is Bavel, but Bavel is just the word for Babylon. Through the rest of the Old Testament, wherever you see Babylon mentioned, the Hebrew word is Bavel. So this, the account in Genesis 11, it's no different. A Hebrew reader is going to see Bavel and is going to think this is talking about Babylon. But I'll explain why I think the English translators have translated it Bavel in this particular context, Babel, in this particular context, rather than put in Babylon. But it's the same word. Okay, let's look at the story of the Tower of Babel. If you'll recall, in Genesis, the first 11 chapters are really devoted to giving the reader a sense of what sin is, what human sin is. And it starts out with the story of the eating the fruit from the tree in the Garden of Eden, an innocent sin. I mean, it's no big deal. They just ate some fruit that they shouldn't have eaten. So it begins that way. That's the first sin that we see in Genesis. But very quickly, in chapter 4, we have Cain killing Abel. Now that's more serious. That's real sin. And we see that it's not as innocuous as it appears in chapter 3. It's a more serious thing that's going on that has infected humankind. And so we trace the development of sin. We see it in various aspects as we go through the first 11 chapters of Genesis, which culminates with the story of the flood, in which God decides, he says, I'm sorry I made these people. I'm going to wipe them all out. and he brings on the flood, and he only spares Noah and his family. But then, of course, right after the flood doesn't change people. Right after the flood, we have a son of Noah who dishonors his father. Noah makes wine, he gets drunk, and is uncovered in his tent, and Ham, his son, just laughs at him. And clearly that is indicative of dishonoring his father. So that happens right after the flood. So the flood didn't cure anything. The sin that we see in the first 11 chapters, it persists through the flood. Chapter 11 comes right after that, right after Ham dishonoring his father, and then some genealogical information. Then we go right into the Tower of Babel. The first two verses of Genesis 11, the story of Babel, says, "Now the whole world had one language and a common speech. As men moved eastward, they found a plain in Shinar and settled there." There's the mention of Shinar. As I've already said, I think that's very significant that the term Shinar is used here and that it is repeated in Daniel chapter 1. It says the whole world had one language and a common speech. Apparently, there was linguistic and probably cultural homogeneity throughout the world. This is after the flood. People are beginning to spread over the world. We don't know how much time has passed since the flood to the time of the Tower of Babel. But there's probably pretty much both linguistic and cultural homogeneity in the world. It could be that it's just in that region that we have that kind of homogeneity. It's not entirely clear. But cultural and linguistic homogeneity is the condition for unity. That's what you need to have unity, is you have to have a common language, a common culture, common values. That's what makes cooperation among people possible. It says they moved to Shinar. So apparently they were nomadic or semi-nomadic at this time. They were traveling around. They traveled to Shinar. They have made their way to Shinar from Ararat. That's where the ark landed. Ararat is in what is now Armenia, up in the mountains. And presumably Noah and his family settled in the vicinity of Mount Ararat. And then people began to spread out from there. This group came from that area to Mesopotamia. When they reached Mesopotamia, what they found there was a fertile plain. Now that's attractive, because a fertile plain makes it possible to have abundant vegetation. They found this fertile plain, and it says that they wanted to settle there. So they settled in this location. It's not clear who the they is. That has not been made specific, but it's apparently descendants of Ham, because earlier in the genealogy, it is the descendants of Ham through Nimrod that end up settling in Shinar. It is specifically stated that that's the case. And Assyria developed out of the descendants of Ham. They settled in Mesopotamia, we know that. So it's the descendants of Ham that seem to be the people who end up settling in Mesopotamia originally. And we can tell from the narrative in Genesis that this is the most rebellious branch of Noah's family that's settling here. Now, from extra-biblical information, we can put together a certain amount, we can understand a certain amount about what happened in Mesopotamia. There's a lot of material that's been written about this, because this area is known as the cradle of civilization. It is believed that this was the earliest place on earth where civilization got started. And let me just go through briefly a description of how scholars look at this, the development of civilization in Mesopotamia. Before the agrarian revolution, that is, before people begin to settle down and farm land intensively and full time, people were hunters and gatherers. So they would move from one place to another, and they would find food. They'd either collect berries or dig up roots or whatever and kill animals. And that is the way that they made a living. That's the way that they survived. And these people were nomadic frequently, sometimes semi-nomadic. Sometimes they would settle in a certain area and collect food, harvest food in an area, and then before they move on to the next, to another area. The development of agriculture was a long process, a very long process. It took hundreds of years. And it started out with people discovering that they could go to places where there was, say, wild wheat or something like wheat. And they realized that they could come back to that same place year after year and harvest it and eat it. But they apparently realized that if they took some of what they harvested and they spread that around, when they came back next year, there would be even more wheat to harvest. And so that process of aiding the natural process of leaving seeds and growing new plants, that apparently agriculture grew out of that discovery, that they could aid, they could do things to increase the harvest. And that's what they did. It would appear that from the archaeological evidence that it was nomadic peoples and semi-nomadic peoples that moved to the plains, the highlands of Iran. And they discovered that they could aid nature in producing more grains on the slopes of that lead up to the highlands of the plateau that Iran is located on. So it was on those slopes that they began to experiment with developing agriculture. And over time, what they realized is if they could go down onto the plain, the nice thing about the slopes is there was rainfall. It was the same kind of thing that we have on the western slopes of the Cascades, that as the clouds have to rise to go up over the mountains, they drop their rain. Well, the same thing happened in this, the slopes leading up to the plateau of Iran. On the plain down below of Mesopotamia, hardly any rain at all. But it had very fertile soil. So the question was, how can we make use of this very fertile soil when there's no rain? Well, there was a lot of water. The Tigris and Euphrates River flowed down through the plains of Mesopotamia. So now they've got really fertile soil. They've also got water, but the water isn't in the right place. So what they do is they develop means by which to irrigate their fields. They realize that if they divert those waters into their farmlands, and they can have water whenever they want it and in whatever quantities they want it, they've got very fertile soil, so they can take grains that they've collected on the hillsides, bring those and plant those, and they can have abundant crops. And apparently that's exactly what happened. What they realized, though, is in order to develop these irrigated lands, they had to, it took a lot of manpower. You had to invest a lot in the digging of those canals and developing those canals so that they were usable. That took a lot of manpower. And it took a lot of cooperation between people. One person couldn't do enough of that to develop their fields. So they developed these public works projects where they would cooperate and build these canals, and then they could have abundant crops. They did have, it was not as blessed as Egypt was. Egypt had flooding that came annually. It was gentle. It was consistent. They could count on it. And so very little had to be done to develop the irrigation in the Nile Valley. So it makes sense that Egypt became a very wealthy empire early in history. In Mesopotamia, they have the abundant water, but they have severe flooding at times that could not be predicted. And as a result, the construction and maintenance of irrigation canals was a bigger problem in Mesopotamia than it was in the Nile Valley. But they figured out how to do this, how to irrigate these lands. And because they could create abundant crops, they could live there all year round. They could build houses. And they could just stay there. And because they had abundant crops, they had more than enough food that they needed. So they could build places to store the extra grain that they raised. And they did that. So then they can build up surpluses that can be used in times when the crops aren't good. So that's fantastic. The only problem, and they can take that surplus and they can trade that to nomadic peoples and semi-nomadic peoples who are finding things that would be valuable for the people in Shinar to use. And they can trade food for those other things. A wonderful situation. But there's one problem with it. If you've got that much food and you're able to accumulate other valuable things, sooner or later, some of those nomads are going to raid you and they're going to steal whatever they can get. So that led to the development of cities. And in the ancient world, the word city doesn't just mean a community of people. The word city means a walled settlement, a settlement with a wall around it, a defensive wall around it. And so that's what develops in Mesopotamia. It's the first place in the world, as far as we know, that develops a city-based culture with walled cities to protect the wealth that they have developed. In general terms, then, the extra-biblical information is consistent with the biblical story of the development of Mesopotamia, and Babel fits into that context. Verses 3 and 4. They said to each other, "Come, let's make bricks and bake them thoroughly." They used brick instead of stone and tar for mortar. Then they said, "Come, let us build ourselves a city with a tower that reaches to the heavens, so that we may make a name for ourselves and not be scattered over the face of the whole earth." So this is a highly cooperative undertaking. They're going to start building stuff, and they're going to build it. They're going to build stuff for the common good. They're going to build a city with a tower. And it will benefit all of them. And they urge one another to put their hearts into it, not to cut corners. It says to bake the bricks thoroughly. It's not immediately clear what they're building, but that becomes clearer as we progress through the narrative. The thing that makes this construction possible is a technological breakthrough. The problem that they had was how to create building materials where there were none. There are no forests. There are no stone quarries. They don't have natural building materials. So how can they build anything? What they realize, what they discover, is that they can take the clay, which is in abundance in the plain, they can shape that into bricks, they can bake those bricks, and then they can use tar, which is in abundance there, to stick those bricks together, and they can make their own stones to the shape that they want size they want. They can build whatever they want using those materials. So what they were able to do was to create a stone-like material from nearly nothing. And this is an almost godlike achievement. So they want to take advantage of that technological breakthrough to bring about this project of building a city. The term city is used in this section three times. So clearly the city is a significant part of this project. And the city is needed, as I mentioned, as a defensive structure to protect the wealth that they are able to accumulate now. It says they're going to also build a tower with a top in the heavens. And this hints at an aspiration to divine-like status. It's a hubris, a godlikeness that they want to achieve. Sarna says, generally the Bible regarded tall towers as symbols of human arrogance. And then he gives several contexts where it's used that way. So they're going to build a city. They're going to build a tower. They're also going to make a name for themselves. They're going to be famous. They're going to become immortal. Sarna says, a name here probably connotes monument, as in Isaiah 56:5. This meaning developed from the fact that the names of most of the important kings of Mesopotamia were associated with great building projects designed to assure the monarch's eternal fame. The royal name and titles were inscribed on bricks and cylinder seals that were deposited in the foundations of the ziggurats. Thus, a temple inscription of Gudea of Lagash records that, on account of the great name that he made for himself, he was received among the gods into their assembly. Nebuchadnezzar, who restored the ziggurat at Babylon, records in a commemorative inscription, "The fortification of Ezagila and Babylon I strengthened and made an everlasting name for my reign." So it's eternal fame and even godlikeness that is indicated by making a name for themselves. And then finally it says, lest we be scattered. And that's really the main goal here, because they realize that the thing that makes it possible for them to do godlike things is when they work together as a cooperative undertaking. So they need to keep themselves together to keep themselves safe, secure, and retain their prosperous way of life. Sarna says, however, in the present context, the stated purpose of the builders, that we not be scattered all over the world, constitutes a direct challenge to the intent of God, as expressed in the blessing to post-diluvial humanity. Fill the earth. Man did not perceive this to be a blessing, and so devised means to thwart its fulfillment. In other words, as Sarna understands it, they should have continued to spread throughout the world rather than stopping and building a city, because God had told them to go out and fill the world. And he sees this as a violation of the commandment that was given to them. Verses 5 through 7. But the Lord came down to see the city and the tower that the men were building. The Lord said, if as one people, speaking the same language, they have begun to do this, then nothing they plan to do will be impossible for them. Come, let us go down and confuse their language so they will not understand each other. So the people had begun this building project. And it says that God came down to see the tower. Clearly, the tower didn't reach into heaven if God came down to see it. It refers to men in the Hebrew as literally sons of men. And that phraseology emphasizes the fact that these are mere mortals that are doing this construction and trying to build this tower that reaches into heaven. They share a common language and culture, which makes it possible for them to work together. And if they can work together, they can accomplish very big things. They will be able to do almost anything. They will be able to carry out all of their hubristic projects. And that would be disastrous for mankind and for the whole world. That's why I think God decided to come down and frustrate their efforts. God says, let us then. Back when it said, let us then, earlier, it was the people saying, let us then make bricks and bake them thoroughly. Here, God is saying what he's going to do in response. Let us then. And what he decided to do was to come down and to confuse their communication. It is interesting. There are a lot of plays on words that occur in the Old Testament in these kinds of texts. And this is one of them. The word for brick is the mirror image of the word to confuse. Here's what Sarna says. It can hardly be coincidental that navla, a unique form of the Hebrew stem balal, to confuse, is a disarrangement of levena, which means brick. The order of the first three consonants being reversed. The device underlines the teaching that a human enterprise that runs counter to the will of God is inherently perverse and doomed to self-defeat. So God's going to take their great innovation, the brick, and he's going to turn it right back on them and confuse them, make it impossible for them to communicate. And without the ability to communicate then, they won't be able to cooperate on these kinds of hubristic efforts, undertakings. And that's what God decided to do, to make this hubristic undertaking a failure. Verses 8 and 9. So the Lord scattered them from there all over the earth. They stopped building the city. That is why it was called Babel, because there the Lord confused the language of the whole world. From there the Lord scattered them over the face of the whole earth. So God came down and he confused their language. And by confusing their language, he caused them to fail in all of their goals. He scattered them, which is what he had told them to fulfill to fill the earth. They had stopped. God caused them to take off again, to be scattered again. They stopped building the city and the tower, which they had set out to do as one of their goals. And they became infamous, not famous, but infamous. In the NAT, the notes to the NAT, it says, here is the climax of the account. A parody on the pride of Babylon. In the Babylonian literature, the name Babili meant the gate of God. But in Hebrew, it sounds like the word for confusion, and so retained that connotation. The name Bavel and the verb translated confused, Balal, form a paronomasia, a sound play. So the place became infamous, becomes known as Babel, and Babel in Hebrew sounds like the word to confuse, or confusion. So what we have here in Genesis 11 is a story of people coming together, forming a unity, and they are doing it to seek their own personal security and prosperity. And what happens is that God reveals the fact that when that happens, it is inherently chaotic. What we have in the construction of the Tower of Babel is we have chaos held together with baling wire. And sooner or later, that's not going to work. Chaos will break out eventually, and God acts to break that chaos out. God's punishment is just unleashing the natural outcome of the city, which is self-destruction. Okay, what's the significance of this story in Genesis? As I mentioned before, in Genesis, we see the development of sin in the first 11 chapters of the book. And at first, sin seems like it's rather trivial, insignificant. But as we progress through the narrative, it becomes clear that no, sin is a really serious problem. And that leads to murder. So God punished people for their sin on several occasions, most notably in the flood. But this did not stop sin, as I've already mentioned. And right after the flood, Ham disrespected his father. And his descendants follow in that trend. After the flood, people are told to be fruitful, multiply, and fill the earth. The descendants of Ham go to Mesopotamia, but they want to settle there. They don't want to be scattered, and they build the Tower of Babel. So here we see in the Tower of Babel the first time that we have a group of sinners living out their rebellion in concert with one another. They discovered that community could attain God-likeness, that is, outlandish hubris. And God was not going to allow this illusion to stand, the illusion that they were indeed God-like. He unsettled them, sent them on their way. And he did this by creating cultural and linguistic differences. And this smashed the illusion of a community of egoists. A community of egoists is not possible. As it progresses, right after the story of the Tower of Babel, we have the introduction of Abram. And in the story of Abram, God takes a man out of the most citified area of the world of the time. He came out of Ur of the Chaldeans, which is really interesting because the Chaldeans did not exist. As far as we know, the Chaldeans did not exist at the time of Moses. So if Genesis was written at the time of Moses, the Chaldeans shouldn't be there. The term is anachronistic. But at a much later date, the Chaldeans became the dominant ethnic group in Babylon. So when it says Ur of the Chaldeans, it's saying that area in southern Mesopotamia that later is known as the homeland of the Chaldeans. The people who took the Jews out of Judah into exile into Babylon. I suspect that when it says the Ur of the Chaldeans, that the Chaldeans is a late edit that was made to the book of Genesis. But in any case, using the term Ur of the Chaldeans, it draws attention to the fact that Ur was in the land of Babylon. There's a strong association between the two. So it's out of Babylon, in essence, the most urban area in the entire world at the time, that God called Abraham and calls him into a life of semi-nomadic existence. God says in Genesis 12:1, "And the Lord said to Abraham, 'Leave your country, your people, and your father's household, and go to the land I will show you.'" He took him out of that place of security and prosperity and took him to a land that Abraham didn't even know where he was going, didn't know what it was like. But God said he would care for him. God said he would bless him, and he did. So it's an interesting juxtaposition, the Tower of Babel and the story of Abraham. What became of Babel or Babylon after the tower? We don't know all of the details, but as I mentioned, that location became the location of the first civilization, the Sumerian civilization. And the Sumerian civilization lasted a very long time. It lasted thousands of years. It eventually fell into chaos. It was eventually attacked by nomadic people from Iran, and it was destroyed and turned into chaos. But out of the chaos eventually developed Old Babylon, the Old Babylonian Kingdom, from 1830 to 1530. And the most notable person from that time is Hammurabi, from 1792 to 1750. He was the king in Old Babylon. But Old Babylon eventually was replaced by the Kassite Kingdom, which was, the Kassites were a people that were that lived just north of Babylon. And they had a kingdom there and from 1530 to 1357. Then that was replaced by the Assyrians from 1356 to 612. So that's a very long time. The Assyrians were very strong early in that period. Then they became weak and did not have much of a kingdom for an extended period of time. And then the Neo-Assyrian Empire came into being. That's the one that in the 700s invaded Palestine, defeated the northern kingdom of Israel, and dispersed the people of Israel into different parts of the Assyrian Empire. So that was the Neo-Assyrian Empire that did that. Then, after the Neo-Assyrian Empire fell at the hands of, ultimately, Nebuchadnezzar, the Neo-Babylonian Empire begins. It begins about 612. That's when they drove the Assyrians out of Nineveh, and it lasts until 539, when it is conquered by the Persians. Okay, what's the significance of the story of the Tower of Babel to the book of Daniel? It seems to me that there are clues about the fate of empire that are embedded in the biblical narratives from the very beginning of history. God created the history of mankind with a great deal of coherence, and that coherence is identifiable. We can find the coherence in the story of history. And one of the things that we see in the story of history from the very beginning is what is going, where history is going to go, what its end will be. There are hints of that in Genesis, I would argue, and in particular with respect to human organization, large human organizational entities. I read this last week, but I'll repeat it from Isaiah 46:10. I make known the end from the beginning, from ancient times, what is still to come. There were hints from the Garden of Eden how history would play out. And there are lots of hints along the way that help us to understand more fully where history is going and what's going to happen. And it seems to me that the story of Babel is one of those. It's a hint with respect to what is going to happen to empire. Empire is going to develop along the lines of the Tower of Babel, the building of the Tower of Babel. Empire will have a lot of those qualities, and empire is going to develop and reach its perfect form. Empire and the building of the Tower of Babel are, it seems to me, the same kind of project. In the first 10 chapters of Genesis, as I've already said, we have a charting out of the picture of sinful man, starting with the eating of the fruit in the Garden of Eden. And what this evolves into is a drive for city. And as many of you know, I've mentioned it, Jack's mentioned it, other people have mentioned it. Jacques Ellul wrote a book, The Meaning of City. If you don't have it, you should buy it and read it. The Meaning of City by Jacques Ellul, where he traces the concept of city through the whole Bible and shows what the significance of city is for the biblical narrative. And the way he describes city is virtually the same as the meaning that I am attaching to the word empire. And I think that that's what I'm using empire because that is more closely associated with the text in Daniel, but it's the same concept as far as I'm concerned. Empire is just a continuation of this attempt to unify people around a common purpose. That's what the Tower of Babel was, uniting people for a common purpose. In empire, it becomes multinational, uniting people from diverse cultures together to accomplish a common purpose. In other words, undo what God had done to destroy the attempt to build the Tower of Babel. Empire tries to undo that and bring people together from different languages and cultures, reunify them, and then carry out a unified hubristic project. The common purpose seems to always be to take care of ourselves. It's security. It's security that drives people to empire. So for the purposes of the study of Daniel, I'm going to use the term spirit of empire to capture that. Spirit of empire is the thing that leads us towards the development of empire. And it's fear that drives that. It's the desire for security that drives that. In Daniel, we see the spirit of empire embodied in empire. But the spirit of empire first shows up in Genesis chapter 3. In the story of the Garden of Eden, what happens is Adam and Eve think, they are wondering, who is best at looking out for me? I know that I care about my best interests, but I can't be sure that God really cares about my best interests. So I must at least retain the final veto power on what happens to me, on what I do. That seems reasonable. It seems too reasonable. We think, shouldn't we look out for our own well-being? As an example, shouldn't we buy insurance? Isn't it the case that common sense and the realities of life tell us that we should look out for ourselves? As we look around us, anybody who doesn't look out for themselves, they suffer. In fact, we call people who don't look out for themselves irresponsible. So it is good and true that one should look out for themselves. But ultimately, it comes down to a question that we have to ask ourselves with respect to taking care of our own security. I'm going to express the same idea in two different ways. The first question, would I disobey God for the sake of my security or my well-being? That is, would I disobey God for the sake of what I believe to be my security? Secondly, and the same thing in different words, do I value what I believe to be my security or well-being too much? The sweep of history, then, is this tapestry of billions of people all over the world over centuries trying to take care of themselves, looking out for their own interests. And this has been driven mainly by what I'm calling the spirit of empire. And what has happened as a result of people being driven by the spirit of empire is that there have been wars and inhumane behavior over time, every time, every place. We've seen it manifested, sometimes in horrific ways. There is a natural progression built into the spirit of empire. It starts with a desire for security, just looking out for my needs, just making sure I can survive. But inevitably, if that's secured, then it continues into a desire for comfort. It just slips into the next stage, which is comfort. If I could just have lots of security, if I could have security on top of security. So I'm calling that comfort. But then comfort is still insufficient. It progresses into a desire for prosperity and abundance. That's the only thing that can really secure me. So needs always expand. Mere survival grows to comfort, which grows to the desire for abundance. And when teaching about Roman history, the history of the Roman Empire, I always joked that Rome defended its way into a world empire. It didn't believe in wars of aggression. Wars of aggression were against their values. But Rome became increasingly ready to make preemptive strikes to make sure that they were safe. Wherever they saw any threat at all, they would attack. And they started seeing threats everywhere. And as a result, Rome defended its way into an empire. But the quest for perceived personal security or well-being always leads to chaos. The unity of shared interest of personal security is very superficial. It's just thin skin deep. Because it was always the case that my perceived personal security is ultimately in conflict with my neighbor's perceived personal security. As we know from current events, if I go and buy some toilet paper, somebody else won't be able to. So I'm looking out for my security and undermining the security of someone else. And that happens all the time. My security comes into conflict with other people's security. So chaos, conflict is just under the surface in any human community. So any grand scheme of the unification of people eventually collapses. Now, over the course of history, God has allowed that human drive for empire to play itself out in various ways, in various times. But like the Tower of Babel, it has been his want to only let it develop to a certain point, and then he allows that effort to collapse of its own weight. He lets it fall apart. I have another book on my shelf by Francois Braudel, who made the claim that no major civilization has ever been destroyed from without. They've always been destroyed from within. They all collapse of their own weight. Sooner or later, they just lose their will to survive. I think that has been God's way of handling empires, to allow them to fall apart naturally. And God has acted to do that. I mean, God is as active in history all the time. History is the creation of God. But it has been God's patience, giving people time to repent, that has caused him to allow these empires to fall apart before they reach their perfect form. But if I understand the prophetic picture correctly, at the end of history, the drive for empire is going to be allowed to reach its full potential, so that we will see how futile and horrible it is. We're going to see empire writ large. And when it's writ large, it will be painfully obvious that it is neither cute nor innocuous. It is going to be truly ugly, breathtakingly ugly. However, old empire at the end of history will be completely destroyed. God will destroy it at the end of time, and it will never be allowed to return, be destroyed forever. We see this in Daniel, but it's even more clear in the book of Revelation. It's spelled out in more detail in the book of Revelation. But what we see in Daniel is the empire will be replaced by a kingdom. This kingdom that will replace it will have a fundamental and unshakable unity. Instead of being centered around everybody's personal security, it's going to be centered around a deep felt gratitude towards God and total obedience to God. It'll be made up of people from every language and culture. They will be brought together, but in a way that's very constructive and not chaos smoothed over. And there will be eternal security for everyone that God will provide. In the meantime, we are called to come out of Babylon, like Abraham. And I think Daniel is at least a partial answer to that question, what it means to come out of Babylon. So in Daniel, there will be visions that will present the nature of empire and how God's people ought to relate to it in the meantime, in the interim, while we're here, how it is that we ought to relate to this entity. And we'll start looking at that next week. Okay. I did leave time for questions. So I'll turn on my chat, and if you have questions, please send them in. Okay. Ron asked, could you say again why you think Daniel uses the word Shinar? I think Daniel is using the word Shinar to conjure up the connotations that are attached to that term. And the connotations that are attached to that term are the connotations of power and seduction, primarily. But the word Shinar is also the location of Babel, and the Tower of Babel. So I think that he used the word Shinar to conjure up all of the connotations with that word, and that includes the Tower of Babel. And that's doubly true because the Tower of Babel, that's the Tower of Babylon. So there's a strong association there. Any other questions? Question, would you consider the moon landing a Tower of Babel? That's a good question. I do. One thing that's difficult about these kinds of things is what is the motivating force between some of these accomplishments? I think that there are really significant accomplishments that have been undertaken and achieved that are not driven by the spirit of Babel. There are other things that are, obviously, they're really insignificant things that are done with the spirit of Babel. And the question is, are we doing something to achieve God-likeness? Are we doing something to free ourselves from the constraints that God in creation has placed upon us? So it seems to me that the same act done by through the spirit of empire is hubristic and damnable. Another person working on the same invention, for instance, it could be not hubristic. So it really depends on the motivation that's behind it. And I say that because I think that the primary motivation between the landing on the moon was probably hubristic. But that doesn't mean that everybody that worked on it was driven by that same motivation. But I think ultimately it probably was a hubristic undertaking. That's a good question. Any other questions? Shelby asks, considering our culture's emphasis on unity, do you see it rooted in something evil? Again, it depends. It's a matter of diagnosing what is the primary motivation behind it. And I think, just as an observer of our culture, I think the driving force behind it is indeed hubristic. Certainly, the driving forces behind globalization, I think. That's primarily hubristic. Because that's an attempt, and many are quite outspoken about it. It's an attempt to solve the world's problems through the cooperation between different peoples. Margaret asks, last week you said something like, Daniel asked the question, what should my life be about? Is the answer the same for all godly people? Yes and no. That ultimately, yes, the answer is the same for all godly people. And the question is, why am I here? Why did God make me? And God made me to be a servant of him. So in that sense, it's the same for all godly people. But that can be broken down. There are aspects to that. And one godly person might be directed in a different direction than someone else. But the ultimate answer, I think, is the same for all godly people. Well, thank you very much for listening. And next week, we'll actually dive into the book of Daniel. Thanks for listening. Bye.